Hi, it's Brad, and I'm going to talk real fast so you can get right to the show. Justin and I have already recorded our opening segment, and now I have some news. Those that live outside the United States can participate in the review contest for a $50 gift card. Just click on the notes for the website, queerwritersofcrime.com, and then at the top, click Review Contest. You'll get details there, and I'll have more when we come back next week. Welcome to Queer Writers of Crime, featuring interviews with renowned LGBTQ authors and up-and-coming talent in mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. I'm your host, Brad Shreve, and Justine is here to give her weekly recommendation. Well, Justine, I noticed that you must be recording outside again because I've heard some crows cawing in the background.
Yes, yes. And you know, if you ask about the crows too often, I'm going to tell you everything I know about crows, which is an awful lot.
No, that's not what this show is about.
That's not what the show is about. But just so you know, they crow like that because they hear you. They don't crow like that when I'm on the phone and they can't hear the other person.
Well, we could talk about crows. We talked about zombies a few weeks ago, but now let's stick with our format.
That sounds good.
So our guest today, you have reviewed two of his books. You liked them very much. And it is Timothy J. Smith.
Oh, good. Oh, good. I'm looking forward to that.
Fascinating man.
Yeah.
He has done a lot in his life, and we cover a bunch of it.
Great.
At the same time, I am distraught.
Oh, dear.
We have this review contest.
Yeah.
All somebody has to do is leave a review, and they'll be put in a drawing for a $50 gift card.
Yes.
And we've had no new reviews.
No.
And if you like this show and you want other people to say, hey, looks like people like this show, leave us a review. And the rules are easier than they were before.
How much easier are they?
It's this easy. It no longer has to be on Apple. There is a review button on the show notes. You're looking right at it right now. So click the review button. And any of the apps that you have that accept reviews will pop up.
Okay.
If it's an app they don't have, it won't pop up.
Okay.
It's Apple's iTunes, Podchaser, Stitcher, and CastBox. But don't worry about it. Just click that button.
All right.
And if they want to know the rules, they can go to the website, and there is a button there that says Review Prize Drawing, and they can get the rules.
But all they really need to know is there's a $50 gift card up for the taking.
Yes, and why not do it?
Mm-hmm.
It ends January 31st.
So you think when if nobody enters, we can just like give it away? It'll be like a sudden death finish. The first one who reviews after that.
Maybe we'll give it to somebody to exterminate your crows.
Hey, no, I like the crows.
So anyway, get those reviews in. I made it really easy for you. We'd love to quite a few people in to draw for that prize.
Yeah.
All right. That's enough of my begging and pleading. And I don't know what the word is. That's enough of my begging and pleading. So what do you have for us today, Justine?
I am interviewing Fast, Free, and Flying by Jude Tresswell. It's book 6 of the series. And we all know how much you love when I start at the end of a series.
Yes.
But, you know, not everybody's got time to put into a full series. And often the later books, they're really when the author is getting going and the characters are fully developed and the author's writing style is kind of polished. And so every now and then I like to start with the latest one.
Actually, I'm going to correct you. I don't mind reading out of order in a series if the story doesn't carry over too much. I mean, I've mentioned the burglar mystery series many times. There's like 25 or 30 of them. I haven't read them all. I picked and choose the ones I wanted because the story doesn't carry over. If the story carries over, then I don't like it.
Well, some of this carries over. I mean, the development, the relationship between the main characters obviously increases.
And that's okay a little bit.
Yeah. And then they mentioned some of the previous stories.
Okay.
If I don't think there's a lot of spoilers involved.
But you were able to pick it up and enjoy it.
I was able to pick it up and enjoy it, yes.
That's the important part.
Yep. It took me a little while at the beginning because there's a lot of characters and, somewhat complicated setting. Let's head into that, okay?
Okay.
so in the basket of the various letters, there are some that are less commonly used. And in this story, there are four men who are living in a poly relationship. And one of them also has a relationship with a man who is asexual. So there's five main people. They get along very well. They're all given a fair amount of time. And let me just say, one thing I discovered about myself is that I have a personal preference for hard-boiled PIs who handle relationships by grunting.
Okay.
That's probably not very good for a poly relationship. And there's an awful lot of conversation about the relationships or about what's going on between the four of them. And so there's just a lot of communication. And I thought it was very interesting in exploring how poly relationships work, also how asexual relationships work. Jude has a website in which he has a lot of material on both those sexualities. You know, I think if you pick up a book, something like this, it gives you a window into that if it's not your inclination.
It's not my thing, but I've read her blog and I found it very interesting.
Yeah. So there are two couples, Phil and Wraith are married, and Ross and Mike are civil union. They live together in the same house. They all are in relationships with each other. And then Nick, who is asexual, lives in another house, and he is in a relationship with Mike, but he's also part of the group.
Wait, that's five of them?
There's five of them, yes. Four poly and one asexual.
Okay, in the past there's always been four.
Well, because there's a four poly and then there's a fifth who's asexual.
Okay, you're right.
Got it?
Yep.
And so I assume that the previous five books have developed this a little more slowly. So it's a little hard to catch up in the first paragraph, in the first chapter, and figure out who all these people are. Although by, you know, 10-20% into the book, you know them all and they're all very unique. And they run this artist colony together. And I think the artist colony is probably been developed in other books, and it's described, you know, one of them does this and the other does that. Wraith is a particularly creative person who does not think in a very linear manner. When they have group meetings where they decide what to do, he takes the minutes and pictures. I can't describe it more than that, but the author describes it very well. You get a sense for the fact that how he draws the pictures, and you really can use them as minutes of what happened in the meeting. It was really quite fascinating. So in the middle of all this, you find out, by the way, in previous books, almost all of them have been kidnapped. And the one who hasn't been kidnapped yet is Mike, and he gets kidnapped as part of a string of kidnappings.
It was his turn.
And, you know, there's a lot of discussion about, well, you know, this person's been kidnapped, this person, the police haven't helped us in the past and not going to help us now. There's also a string of burglaries of the mansions in the area, stealing jewelry and art. And two of these guys are ex-cops who, one of them was, he investigated art fraud. So for reasons that are remarkably unclear, except for the fact that the local constable is homophobic, they are suspected of these burglaries. And I got to say, they remain suspects long after I think they ought to remain suspects, solely because the local detective is very homophobic. However, between the five of them, they investigate these burglaries and the kidnap and string of kidnappings. And what's interesting is I would investigate the kidnappings first, but they choose to investigate the burglaries first, mostly because Mike is recovering and also because they're suspects in the burglaries and they want to get themselves in the clear. And so they have to figure out who else does it. And all these storylines are woven together in a way that, you know, once I kind of got past the initial who are all these people to each other and what role are they playing within this village, was very understandable, very clear, and there were no loose ends at the end. And I thought it was just a marvelous book.
Well, the cop is definitely an asshole, because I would say the kidnappings take precedence over a burglary. But
well, you would think after one of them is kidnapped and after they've all been kidnapped and two of them are ex-cops, why would you suspect them of burglaries? Because they're gay. and you want to pin something on them.
That works.
So, but it's getting a delightful recommendation. I think people will enjoy it. If they want more of a slow development, they ought to start at the beginning. But if you're looking for something that's fun for an afternoon read, pick this book up.
And what do you have from Weird Queer Tales today?
Well, the end of the year, we're planning out a new Nikki Baker release. And we're also going to have a new Grant Michaels release. So if you have not read those books in the series, now is the time to pick them up. They're all on Kindle Unlimited. And you'll be up to speed when we release the new editions.
So before we go, I want to remind everybody, look at the show notes in your phone or on your PC, whether there, and hit the review button. And it makes it really easy for you.
Sounds great.
Okay. And sit back and listen to Timothy J. Smith. You're going to hear what happened to him after he stowed away on a ship. And that's only one of his interesting stories.
He never got kidnapped, though, did he?
I don't think so. I'd have to think that one out.
Okay. Talk to you next week, Brad.
Okay. See you then. We're sponsored by Requeered Tales, preserving our LGBTQ literary heritage one book at a time. Check them out at requeeredtales.com. Ray's crisscrossing America, pulling a small green trailer behind the family car, Timothy J. Smith developed a ceaseless wanderlust that has taken him around the world many times. En route, he's found the characters that people his work. Polish cops and Greek fishermen, mercenaries and arms dealers, child prostitutes and wannabe terrorists, Indian chiefs and Indian tailors, he hung with them all. Timothy has won top honors for his novels, screenplays, and stage plays in numerous competitions. Fire on the Island, published in 2020, previously won the gold medal in the 2017 Faulkner Wisdom Competition for the novel, and his screenplay adaptation of it was named Best Indie Script by Write Movie. Welcome to Queer Mystery. Oh, that's our old name. Welcome to Queer Writers of Crime, Timothy.
Thank you.
Let me begin by saying well done for having your two most recent novels, Fire on the Island and The Fourth Courier, recommended by Justine on the show.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, right.
She gave The Fourth Courier a thrilling recommendation and Fire on the Island a glowing recommendation. We're going to talk about Fire on the Island in a moment. But first, the stories in your four novels have different locations. Cooper's Promises in a small African country. A Vision of Angels is in the Middle East, basically Israel and the Gaza Strip. The Fourth Courier is in Poland. And then Fire on the Island is in Greece. As I said on the intro, you have an amazing travel history, and some we'll discuss later. But when you get that flicker of an idea to write a story, which comes first? Is it the plot or the location?
What really comes first for me is what I really want to write about. I use my writing. I'm a very political animal, and I've always been politically conscious, and I've been active since my very early youth in different causes and different things. So when I decide I'm going to write a novel, I decide what I want to write about first. So it's not that I want to write a novel set in Africa, but I want to write a novel about human trafficking. And where is that going to be set? And what do I know best? And what makes sense? But it all is really driven by that initial idea of the story or the overall theme, if you want to call it that. It's not really the theme. It's just the issue. I want to illuminate issues for people. So I've written about human trafficking. I've written about what life was like for an ordinary Polish family at the big change from communism to capitalism in 1990. I've written about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict from the perspectives of four key players in that conflict. The Greek book, Fire on the Island, which is my last book published, deals with on an island faced with a refugee crisis, faced with a national economic crisis and things like that. So that's where I start. What do I want to write about? And then I've had this incredible travel life and overseas experiences that have really made a big difference to me. I had an international career. I had a career, first of all, in the States. It took me all over the United States, and I worked with low-income people, literally from Alaska to Puerto Rico. But then I went into an international career that let me work in 33 countries, all doing interesting projects for low-income people and collecting incredible stories and adventures and experiences. So I take the notion of what issue I want to write about and think, where is that best told? And I've got this whole background of international work to draw on that lets me do that. And so that's how it all comes about for me.
Well, you sent me some information, and as always, I did a little snooping on the net, and I got to say, I find your life absolutely fascinating, and I'm somewhat envious of what you've done. Going back to the socially relevant causes that you like to write about, how are you able to do that and be both entertaining?
What I'm trying to do with my writing is to say, okay, here we have a big issue. Like, we have a big issue of human trafficking or a big issue of Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And I take it back and I say, so that's what's going on in these people's lives, but how is it really affecting them? So I really bring it down to intimate stories. These aren't stories driven by message or politics or big things. These are really people stories. And most of these stories are people that I've known, or derived from people that I know in these situations. So that's how I've done that.
And what can you tell us about Fire on the Island, the story, the plot?
I want to step back on Fire on the Island before I talk about the plot for just a second to say that it's set in Greece. It's set on a Greek island. And my first job after college was in Greece. So I lived in Greece in 1972 to 1974 to start with. And I've now spent about 7 years total of my life in Greece, cumulatively, not all at one time. So Fire on the Island is really my homage to Greece. It's a country I love very much. I know the culture very well. I speak the language reasonably well. So I finally, after many years, wanted to write something that was really talking about Greece and the way that I know it, which is from the perspective of the people, because I've lived in only tiny villages and did work on kind of personal issues for people, sometimes like job development or business planning or whatever. Anyway, the story about Fire on the Island, it takes place on the island of Lesbos. I don't identify it in the book. The basic story is that there's been an arsonist who has set many fires, each one closer to one particular village. And now the suspicion has arisen that maybe that village is really the target and the arsonist is playing with the village, which is in fact true. And you kind of understand that from the very beginning. The story is that there's a Greek Coast Guard station in this village with a fuel tank. And that if an arsonist is playing a game and saying, I'm going to burn down the village, the target would be that Coast Guard station. And because that Coast Guard station is playing such an important role in rescuing refugees fleeing Turkey and coming to Greece, that the U.S. government decides to send down its FBI agent who's posted to Athens to investigate who might be the arsonist and try to keep this Coast Guard station operational. So that's the basic story. But through that story, the reader begins to understand the conflicts and dilemmas and difficulties of a contemporary Greek island village, and with, you know, failing tourism and national economic problems and all that sort of stuff. But it's a very personal story. It's a very personal story for me because pretty much everybody portrayed in the book are based on people I really know. Some I've known for 20 or 30 years, and some I've known for a few years. But they all kind of come together in my novel in this, as I say, an homage to Greece that is really talks about my love affair with Greece. I love Greece.
Can you tell us about the relationship in the novel between the protagonist, Nick, who's an FBI agent, and the bartender? Is it Takis?
Takis, yeah. Sure. Well, in all of my novels, in all my work, basically, my main character is gay. The Fourth Courier, there were two main characters, a straight FBI agent and a gay CIA agent who team up and work together. So it's still a lot of gay theme in that. I write these stories using gay characters because I want to also explore a little bit about how gays are treated in various places, because I've lived in these places and I can do that. But when Nick, the main character in Fire on the Island, arrives, he's not obviously there to find a boyfriend, and he's not on vacation. He's there on an assignment. But the waiter in the restaurant sort of next door is gay, and they begin to have a small little love affair. And then it turns out that Takis was involved in a fire not that much earlier, because he's a young guy, you know, 3 or 4 years earlier. A lot of suspicion around it. He was considered an arsonist who may have caused a couple of deaths. And now we have Nick, our main character, actually falling in love with his chief suspect. So it's kind of an interesting story.
Yeah, that causes some conflict.
Yep.
Yeah, and I got to tell you, it's refreshing. It seems like most mysteries, you have an FBI agent who has a relationship or develops a relationship with a cop, or a PI who develops a relationship with a cop. And to have an agent who has an interest in an everyday guy like a bartender, to me, that's more realistic, I guess, because not all of us work in the law enforcement.
Yeah, right. Well, I have other characters too. Like I have a book called Cooper's Promise, which is the second novel I wrote in. He's a deserter from the war in Iraq. He's an army sharpshooter, ends up in Africa, and you know, and he's also gay. And in each of my books, they're not erotic books. They're not, you know, erotica. They're real stories. They're good fiction. And each one of them turns on something that's particularly or especially gay. And if it were about gay protagonists, or really in a gay setting, I mean, a straight protagonist or a straight setting entirely, it wouldn't have worked out the same way. So it's kind of fun to do that, to have gay characters and roles that they aren't usually seen in, and then have, you know, plot twists that are really based on that. So it's not just like, oh, let's have a gay FBI agent, but the way something happens that takes him further into the case would not have happened if he had not been gay, or if there had not been a gay situation that presented itself.
I have a question about Greek culture, something that came up in my novels. I have a couple of Greek characters, and they do speak a little bit of Greek. And to make sure I had it accurate, a friend of mine has a good friend of hers that is Greek. And so I had her check to make sure I had the dialogue correct. And the response he gave was one of anger. He was furious because no way anyone in Greece would be so open and welcoming to a gay relationship. I was floored. I'm like, I'm sure there's plenty of folk that are open to a gay relationship. What's your take on that based on your time there?
I have different perspectives and takes on it. That first, I'll say that homosexuality in Greece in general, traditionally and in society, and even today, is really something very shameful. And it's really sad. And when you see that how people you know are gay or have gay sex occasionally or whatever in these small towns or villages or whatever, you just really feel their shame. You just know how tough it is for them, and they can never be open about it. But of course, Greece is a modern country at the same time. And so things have changed in Athens, I suppose. I haven't been there, and I think things are changed. And in the village that my partner and I go to, have gone to for the last 15 years, which coincidentally is on the island of Lesbos, which is where Sappho came from, which is why lesbians are called lesbians, is because they come from Lesbos. But anyway, you know, we go to a village that's has a little more of a international aspect to it. There are people who have been coming there for 30 or 40 years. Often they're artists. Leonard Cohen lived there for a short time. So this has been going back for a while. So in the place where we live, where we go, there's more acceptance in let's say at the street level, that, you know, people aren't being harassed. There's nothing being said. You don't really have to hide yourself very much, but nobody ever really talks about it either. It's still one of those issues that's just, it's just a shame. You know, there's a tremendous amount of shame around it still. Even if the laws are okay about it, the society is still not quite there for the most part.
That really surprises me. Laws don't necessarily change minds right away. So,
yeah, no, they don't.
I'm really surprised by that. Now, your four action or thriller novels are each standalone. Have you considered an action or thriller series, say a gay version of Jack Ryan or Jason Bourne?
I get asked this a lot, and yes, of course, I've considered it. And I think I've got a couple of characters. I think when Cooper's Promise was published, a lot of people loved the character Cooper, and I do too. And they wanted me to take him into other books, but I just feel like I'm so driven by different things inspire me. I'm inspired to take advantage of the fact that I have had this incredible life experience of travel and work. I mean, I said I worked in 33 countries, but I've traveled to 112, and I've spent and many of those more than once. And I just feel like I can write about different cultures or different situations in a way that will appeal to readers in the Anglo world, whether it's set in Greece or Jerusalem or a fictitious West African country. I think that all works. And I also like the challenge to keep creating new characters. And I feel that's so interesting to do, that to keep going back to the same character, to me personally, that's not a well that's plentiful for me. I don't think I could do 20 books on the same character. It wouldn't interest me personally. I like having new characters, new situations, and so that's why I haven't done it.
Well, regarding Jack Ryan and Jason Bourne, young Alec Baldwin and Matt Damon in my head are both gay, so I'm okay with that for now.
Okay.
Regardless of the fact that it's probably not true in my head, they are. So
I don't know.
The stories of your travels, as I said, are very fascinating, but there's two that stand out that I'd like to hear more of. First, were most of these tales from a single occupation you had?
No, because I started traveling and doing things before I really had an occupation. I was traveling independently overseas, even when I was going through college. I had a general field of work in which I worked, but I never actually worked very long for anybody. I was always almost always an independent contractor, particularly in the international work that I did.
The first story I want to hear about is you smuggled plays from behind the Iron Curtain. Can you tell me more about that story?
Yeah, I can. Yeah. That's a pretty easy story. That was 1974. I had lived in Greece for a couple of years, and I'd gone back to the States, and then I came back to Greece to do a couple of research things. And this is sort of a funny story, but I had actually received a very small grant to buy a donkey and travel along the Greek-Albanian border and photograph it and record it. And what happened was that occurred just when Turkey invaded Cyprus back in 1974. So the Greek generals who had overthrown the Greek colonels who had a coup 7 years earlier created a no man's land along the Albanian Greek border. And so I couldn't do my donkey photographic trip that I planned to. And I decided, well, I'm going to try to go to Eastern Europe. It was 1974, and I'd never known anybody gone to Eastern Europe, really. And it was sort of off limits, but I managed to get visas. And I went up through Bulgaria and three other countries, and one of them was Czechoslovakia, where I had a friend from college who was studying Slavic languages and was in Czechoslovakia for 3 or 4 months or half a year or whatever. And when I got up there, he introduced me to some people who asked me, because I was basically a Berkeley student, if I would take a couple of plays back to the Slavic language department people at Berkeley. I had no idea that the playwrights in Czechoslovakia were the revolutionaries. I said, sure, I'll take the plays. And they said, you got to be careful. I said, okay, I'll be careful. And I just, you know, that's how it happened. It wasn't it was kind of clandestine, but not exactly. And it wasn't because I was a CIA spy or something. It was just that a friend of mine was studying there and had friends who were the playwrights. It could have been Havel. I don't know, you know. It's a long time ago.
It's the kind of thing that falls in the lap of a person that had originally planned to ride a donkey on the Albanian.
I know. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Right. In the winter. It was supposed to be in the winter.
Oh, great. Now, the one I'm even more curious about is you landing in an African jail because you stowed away aboard a devil's barge.
Right.
And let's start with, what is a devil's barge? And I'd like to hear that.
I can't exactly start there because it almost doesn't make sense. But when I finally escaped the situation out of Cabo Verde or Cape Verde. I'm not sure exactly how people say it, which is a group of islands just off the West African coast. The woman who Pension I had been staying in, when she found out how I was finally going to make my escape, said I was going on a devil's barge. I realized later that I was in a lot of trouble and that the people on this barge weren't especially helpful. And in fact, they probably were going to kill me at some point. But I had ended up in Cabo Verde under a very strange situation, which was that I was trying to get to Senegal to visit a friend who was in the Peace Corps there. And there was no traffic between these Portuguese islands and Senegal for political reasons, which I didn't know about. So I was stuck. I was stranded. In fact, I was stranded until the next plane came back in 2 weeks, and that plane was already full. So it looked like I might be stranded for 6 weeks on these islands. And it was very troubling because it was during a period of, it was like 5 years into a drought, and there was literally no food. I mean, women in the marketplace would sell tiny little mounds of rice, and at the end of the day, they'd get down on their hands and knees and pick up the little individual grains of rice that had fallen to the ground. So it was a rough time to be there. And I wasn't the only foreigner there, but I was one of only three foreigners. The other two foreigners were a French couple who had adopted two monkeys as their children and would dress them up as their children. So it was a pretty bizarre experience too.
To say the least.
But that experience actually was the basis for Cooper's Promise. The bar he hangs out in, the brothel, and the situation and the young girl he meets were all people that, and situations that I had on Cabo Verde. But the Devil's Barge was basically, it was a 3-day trip from the islands to Dakar, Senegal. I was not allowed into the boat at all. I was considered a stowaway. I traded a flying fish that I caught after it hit the deckhouse for a couple of hardtack biscuits, and I had one bottle of water, and that was it for 3 days, and I wasn't allowed inside to even use the toilet. So it was a pretty rough passage, to say the least.
Well, it certainly sounds like it. And stereotypically, I believe, and rightfully so, that writers are considered passionate people. And I enjoy digging deeper into other passions that authors have. And you've got a couple. In 2017, you launched the Tanzania Tree and Water Project.
Yeah.
Tell us about that and what prompted you to start it.
What prompted me to start it was a couple of years earlier, my partner and I had been on a safari, and we've been on a few safaris in Africa. But we particularly liked the guy that was our guide and driver and everything. And he was telling us some of the stuff that he was doing in his village and as a local activist to try to improve people's lives, because he comes from a really remote, or not remote exactly, but poor, very poor village. And one of the things he talked about was this notion of local farmers. He was talking them into planting trees that cost about 62 cents right now to plant as a seedling. And you let them grow for 16 years and you sell them for a couple hundred dollars. And this is his notion of what could become a retirement plan for farmers in his village, because there's no government social security or anything like that. So fast forward a couple of years, and I'm thinking, you know, I've always wanted to plant trees in great volumes. And I've tried it through a program in Israel. I tried to do it through a program in Brazil, but the costs were too high to really do it in large volumes. So I contacted this guy about 3 years ago now, 3 or 4 years ago. And I was thinking, I'd like to plant some trees. And I was thinking maybe 50 trees, you know, I mean, it costs a couple bucks a tree probably. And he came back and said, great. And basically going back and forth about how many trees could be planted and what they cost. And when I realized that you could plant 3,000 trees for $1,500, I thought, that's what I want to do. So I just started this project. I get donations from friends. I put in my own money, and we're planting about 3,000 trees a year. So, which is just going to happen again at the end of January. The trees get planted when there's a very short rainy season that comes into Tanzania in January, February. That's where that project came from. And one of the things that's happened is that I went to them and I said, okay, you know, I'm a writer. I use a lot of paper. I want to plant trees. Let me plant trees. And they came back to me and they said, that's great. We really want you to plant these trees. It's really good for us. But, you know, we actually need water. We're 3 miles from the nearest source of water. Can you help us bring the water tap closer? And so I've also done that kind of on my own. I've put in 2 miles of electric line to bring the electricity. to a water tap to have an electric pump. I put in 2 miles of pipe, dug a well, two major, you know, one 5,000 liter and one 10,000 liter storage tank. So all that has become sort of part of this, even though the tree project is really separate because the trees are reasonably drought resistant. But this last year, the rainy season came a little bit late, so the water project actually helped the tree survive. But anyway, that's where all that comes from.
The tree project just sounds like such a great idea because you get such a great outcome for very little amount of money.
Absolutely, yeah. My goal is to basically plant 30,000 trees. You know, I can do that over 10 years. That's 3,000 trees a year is about the capacity of the local farmers to absorb doing that. So it's all staggered. And then 10 years, they got 30,000 trees. They can start harvesting them as they need it, and they've got income, and it's created a new habitat for animals and shade for coffee plants. So the whole thing is really, it's a kind of a win-win for everybody at every level.
Well, like most everything, it seems that you've done, not many people can say I planted 30,000 trees in my life.
Yeah, I know.
Now, on top of those two projects, I don't know if you're restless or glutton for punishment, but you also established the Smith Prize for Political Theater. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I can. I'm really proud of it. We're going into the 16th year of this. I was still living in the States when I did it. I'm really a frustrated playwright. If I still lived in the States, I'd be beating my head against, you know, a theater wall every day. But I was so disappointed back in, I don't know what year it was, let's say 2005, that there was virtually no new drama being shown on Broadway stages. It was the Bush administration, August Wilson's 10th play in his 10-play cycle of documenting the Black experience in America during the 1900s, every decade. Could not get funded for Broadway. They were doing Lion King and a bunch of musicals that made people feel really good, but never made anybody think about very much. And so I just decided I was going to create this playwriting prize for political theater. And I contacted a couple of places about would they want to help administer it and this sort of thing. So it went from being originally a $1,250 prize for an existing play that's developed over 16 years to being a $10,000 commission to write a new play. There are a lot of reasons why we did that, and it's very valuable now what kind of the changes we've made. And when I say we, I mean me and the National New Play Network, which is the organization that actually administers it. I come up with $5,000 a year. They come up with $5,000 a year. Commission is broken into three parts. It's $5,000 to the playwright that's proposed over the next year, as opposed to looking at 300 plays that have already been written. It's really a commission to write a new play based on a proposal. And then there's $2,500 for further development of the play, which means some theaters like Steppenwolf or Marin Playhouse have development programs for playwrights. And so the play gets to go there and be worked on with them, or goes through readings and, you know, public readings that there's feedback and stuff like that. And all that costs something. And then there's $2,500 that's given to the first theater to actually fully produce it and make it part of its season. So there's it's a prize designed to encourage playwrights to write about the socio-political issues of our time, but it also actually gives enough money to develop it to be actually able to be produced. And then it helps these theaters. And there's one theater in Tucson, I don't think it would mind my saying this, it's called Borderlands, that took advantage of that particular subsidy and produced two or three of the Smith Prize plays to be first. And that amount of subsidy saved that theater. It has become one of the leading regional theaters in America. So, you know, the prize is... it has been worthwhile. I think almost every playwright that's won it would say that it made a huge difference at the moment of winning that money to them. One playwright was really ready to quit playwriting because she couldn't afford to keep doing it. She won the prize and she went on to write her next play, which won a Pulitzer Prize. So it's been a fun project and it's been interesting to do. And I'm really glad I'm doing it. And there have been a lot of success stories that have come out of it.
Yeah, that's outstanding. You mentioned The Lion King. I take it you're not a fan of Disney animated films being adapted for stage.
It's not that I'm not a fan of them. It's that I want people to have something else also to think about.
Right.
That was my problem back then.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with pure entertainment, but we need more than that as well.
Right.
A lot of the authors that I interview on this show are actually frustrated screenwriters. That couldn't make it and ended up writing novels, and they've had a good career and enjoy it, but their first love was screenplays. So
may I speak to that? May I say something? Yes, you may. You have time? Okay, so I was really completing my first book, which was A Vision of Angels, Israeli-Palestinian Conflict, really an emotional book. I was at Fine Arts Work Center in Provincetown, Massachusetts. I was ready to take a very short course with Sebastian Junger, who wrote The Perfect Storm. And he said he had just sold the film rights to The Perfect Storm. I asked him, would he write that? He said, no, that's not how the business worked. And he wouldn't do it. He wouldn't write that. And here I was with this novel that was out of my heart and soul. And I thought, you know, if this novel goes and anybody wants to make a movie out of it, I want to know enough about screenwriting that I can have some artistic input into that process. So I went off and studied screenwriting. I took a couple of courses while I was kept writing novels. And then I started writing screenplays. And the screenplay adaptation of my novels is my last editing. It really focuses me as a writer, as a novelist, on what is really the essential dramatic story. And it really pops the dialogue to take the novel into a screenplay. I love writing screenplays. I haven't had any produced. I had a small option that expired on a standalone screenplay, but I still do it because I think it's such a great part of the writing repertoire to be able to do that.
And you're not the first one to say that. I've had other screenwriters and poets as well that say that experience got them to learn to get really to the meat of the matter.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, in a screenplay, in theory, you can write a screenplay to be as long as you want. But if you're not a produced screenwriter and you're not famous and you're not whatever, you have 120 pages and 2/3 of that page is blank. You've just got the style of the screenplay and 120 pages. And that's very tough. Some contests or some people looking at things will give you an extra 10 pages, but no more than that. And people kept saying to me, well, isn't that really like restrictive? And it's not all restrictive. It's enormously creative to be able to make these stories work and take what's really essential in the story and put that in a way that is said in so few words, but everybody gets it. So you get a whole lot going on in very limited words, and it really pops the dialogue. It really helps. Can I say something else about this? I tend to write in scenes. I always have. I just see things on the screen as I write my novels too. And I think that comes from growing up in a family where the television was never turned off. And I was constantly being bombarded with story, but in snippets. So I wouldn't even see much of it, but I would have to be able to understand what was going on. And somehow that in my core, I can do this. So to write a screenplay and take a 300-page novel and turn it into a 120-page screenplay is, yeah, I can do that. I've seen how that's done. So it's interesting to me.
Well, I've never heard anybody tell me that television helped them be a better writer, but it makes total sense.
In terms of forming the notion of a scene, if it's always there, you're going to learn something from it.
I got to tell you, I wish I had a 3-hour show because I could just keep going forever. So when your next book comes out, I definitely need to have you back as a guest.
Okay.
To remind the listeners, it's Timothy J. Smith, and his latest book is Fire on the Island. And I'll have plenty of links in the show notes of things that we discussed.
Thanks. Thanks, Brad.
Oh, thank you for being on the show.
I really appreciate it.
Be sure to subscribe to Queer Writers of Crime wherever you hear our show. Tell a friend too. Thank you for listening.